All right, welcome back to our episode of Everyday Ecclesiology. That was probably the weirdest introduction I've done. Our episode of Everyday Ecclesiology. Sorry that we missed last week. I was supposed to tell you last week that we weren't going to be doing an episode for Thanksgiving, but I dropped the ball. I didn't tell you, but you probably know by now because there wasn't one.
If you consistently listen to our podcast,
that is. You can subscribe, by the way. Pull a page out of Thinkling's book. They did a special episode for Thanksgiving. Made me feel even worse about not doing an episode because they did a special episode because it was Thanksgiving. I was like, okay, are you kidding me? But it was fun. I really enjoyed listening to their podcast. It was nice for our road trip back. So what are we talking about first? What are we doing?
We got back from a Thanksgiving get together with Daniel's family.
Yeah.
So that was nice. Yeah. They got to see Sophia because it's been a while.
Yeah. It's good to get back. It was nice to be able to stay in a hotel as well, have a little bit of space to ourselves while we were back.
A little bit of a reprieve.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a pretty decent deal on a hotel. I mean, with everything that's going on right now, it's pretty easy to find a good deal on a hotel. Yeah. But it was nice to have a consistent place for Sophia to sleep. And we had a vehicle to travel in that had plenty of space, which was pretty nice.
Yep, because we always come home with way more than we went.
Oh, yeah. And what are you working on? What have you got going, Desiree?
Cleaning the house.
Oh, I was looking at the second bullet point. That's always going on, though. You're always good at cleaning the house.
Thanks.
Yeah. The advent calendar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You want to tell them about that?
It's kind of last minute. And
okay, so but I'd your like version to... of last minute is like 3 weeks planning.
Right.
Yeah.
But I would like to research advent calendars more and decide how I want to do them for the rest of our family rather than just like throw something together.
Yeah, my version of throwing something together would be December 1st. Oh man, I got to figure something out by the end of the day and then have an advent calendar. And then at the end of the day, I'd be like, well, I know what we're doing today. And then December 2nd. Oh man, got to figure something out by the end of the day because it's day two.
Yeah.
That would be my version of last minute where it would get done on like December 25th.
Yeah.
Which would probably be like, hey, we'll open presents. Yay, done. So I'm excited to find out what's on the advent calendar because I don't know. I know what today's was. Drink coffee out of a new mug. Had to think about that. And we got a nice little snowflake mug right here that's got some hot chocolate in it because that's what we've been drinking while we're
doing the podcast. I'd like to do something that kind of brings the anticipation up for Christmas, but for the real meaning of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just little fun things.
Yeah.
I don't really have time to think about that stuff.
But I enjoy the little fun things.
Yeah.
Especially drinking coffee.
Yeah, it would be in addition to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose I should describe the mug. The mug is it's a clear mug. Like, I really like clear mugs, because then you can see what's going on in the mug, especially when there's coffee in there. I can see the color of the coffee as it swirls in the cup. It sounds like I'm quoting a proverb about wine, but I'm not. And then when you pour creamer in, if you pour creamer into your coffee, I do sometimes, I don't always. But if you pour creamer into your coffee, then you can see it like and like billow out, and it's really cool to see insides. But this is a clear mug, but it also has like white snowflakes on the outside. So you get like the best of both worlds because then it looks really Christmassy because there's hot cocoa inside it right now and snowflakes on the outside. And it's clear and I can see everything and I really like it. It was a good mug.
And it was a good deal. $1 at Stuff, etc.
Nice. Nice.
Etc. I said it wrong.
That's okay. We got the advent calendar, and then we also did our Christmas shopping. You did half of yours. I blew all of my money for you already.
Yeah, and I still have some for Sophia to do.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what she's getting either. Do I get to find out?
Yeah, sure. Okay. It's just stuff that she needs anyway.
Okay. We also rearranged the living room because we have a table. We're podcasting on a new table, so if there's more echo or anything tonight, it's probably because of the table that we're on. The surface is different. And we're closer to a wall now than we were before. So I tried stuffing some pillows kind of behind us. So hopefully that'll cut down on a little bit of the echo. But I don't know if it'll help at all. Or maybe you won't notice. Maybe I won't notice. I have no idea. But we're in a new spot.
You'll notice, but nobody else will.
Probably. But it's really nice to have like stuff on the table. So like my Bible is right in front of me. And I still have a spot for my phone, which I hope is on silent. Yeah, it's on silent. And our laptop right in front of us, which... seems like it'd be an upgrade to have the laptop right in front of us instead of, like, off on my knee. But we used to have the notes on a big TV, So it's kind of a downgrade, but we're working through it. We're figuring it out.
Yep.
And our new mug that we're drinking hot cocoa out of is sitting on a towel, so you can't hear the big clang when we set it down. But every time I touch the table or flip a page, you're probably going to hear it even louder. So we'll see how it works. I'll figure stuff out as we go. But I'm excited because we have space.
Yeah.
With the rearranged living room. It looks nice. And Sophia's walking.
Well, sort of.
Kind of. I mean, she can take like 10 steps on her own.
In between people. She's not letting go of things and walking yet.
But she is letting go of things and trying to stand. She'll pull herself up on something and then like slowly put her hands in the air and then keep them there as long as she can. And then she'll catch herself. She's like,
praising Jesus. I gotta stop.
Yep. She's like trying as long as she can. She like lifts her hands up. And then when she's confident, she puts them up. So like, look at me, look at me, I'm standing. And then she falls on her butt. But it's funny. She's learning. She's learning pretty quick, and I'm excited to see her actually walk. Not just so she can go out and disc golf with me, but so she can walk around and help you with things in the house and walk outside and don't have to carry her everywhere. That'll be really nice.
Yeah, that'll still be a while, though.
Probably. Or she might figure it out next week. It's Sophia. She's pretty smart. All right, that's what we're doing. Now, what are we learning? Learning two things. I only put one of them there, but the other one's below if you
peek. Lord's Supper and baptism.
Yeah, we got to wrap up baptism. I thought we'd wrap that up last week, but then I went back and looked at the notes, and we missed the last little phrase. And I closed out of the definition, but I think I have it up.
It's right there.
Oh, that's that just the last phrase, yeah. So in understanding baptism, the last phrase we have to look at is, thereby uniting a believer to church and marking him or her off from the world. If you give me a second, I can go back and pull up the full definition. We can read it one more time. Probably wouldn't be bad. It'll take me a couple of taps. Hopefully you don't hear all this through the microphone, but you probably will. It's a nice new setup, but like I said, you're going to hear stuff. So our whole definition for baptism that we've been working through is as follows. Baptism is a church's act of affirming and portraying a believer's union with Christ by immersing him or her in water, and a believer's act of publicly committing him or herself to Christ and his people, thereby uniting a believer to the church and marking him or her off from the world. So what we're looking at is the last part of that, thereby uniting a believer to the church and marking him or her off from the world. And really, it's basically a summary of what we've heard so far. And do you need a jacket?
Yeah.
You want to go grab a jacket?
No, I'll be fine.
It's okay. My camo one's in there.
Okay.
Yeah, I might want to go grab it. If you've followed with what we've said so far, what we've shown so far, what we've been agreeing with and seeing through his explanation of his definition, Bobby Jameson's definition so far, then this will make sense. But there is one thing I'm not quite as strong on as Jameson and the editor Jonathan Lehman would be. So at the end of the definition, Jameson concludes that baptism unites a believer to the church and marks him or her off from the world. Now, I agree with what he's getting at, but I don't agree with 100% with the wording, because a believer is united to the church when he's baptized by the Spirit.
Mm.
He's part of the church universal, as we'd say, because he's a believer in Christ. Now, does he function that way? Does he know people within the church? Well, he knows somebody. Somebody shared the gospel with him. But, I suppose an unbeliever could share the gospel with somebody because they think they're a believer and they explain it, but they don't actually believe it. It's possible, right? What? Somebody could get saved from an unbeliever, right? That's possible.
Well, I mean, it's not the unbeliever, but the Lord that saves them.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, like, somebody could, an unbeliever could share the gospel with somebody, and the other person, one of those unbelievers could get saved, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think that baptism is what actually unites a believer to the church. I think it's helpful, and it functions, and it does help a believer join with a local church, and I get that, but there's also the reality of the universal church that they're already joined to. So it does serve to unite a believer with a local church, but that's not the sum total of what unites a believer to the local church. There's more to it than that, but it does help with uniting a believer to a local church. It is a step in that direction because our church is also united together by the Lord's Supper. We'll get there a little bit later tonight.
Well, I was just thinking, because there are baptized members of churches, but they're not...
Maybe not saved?
...quite as unified with the church.
You know? There's a difference between unified and united.
The quite united with the church. I don't know.
Okay.
What do you mean by there's more than baptism that unites them with the church?
Because it's, in Jameson's explanation at least, baptism is what unites a believer with a church, but then there's a continual meal that we observe that unites us to one another. Okay. Continually, yeah, is what his definitions will say. And I agree with him in part, but I don't think I'd be so strong about baptism unites a believer to the church. I don't think I might word it that way. I agree with what he's getting at, I think, but I probably wouldn't word it that strongly, if that makes a little bit, okay, of sense. So I would agree that baptism serves to, for a believer, when they are baptized, they're saying, hey, I'm joining with you guys in serving. I'm joining to a local church. I'm joining to this one. Otherwise, why would you get baptized at a church that's not, or why would you get baptized with a church family that's not the one you're going to actually join?
Yeah.
I mean, there could be instances where you're at another church building, to use their baptistry, but you're going to do it with the church family you're joining. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You look confused.
Well, what about people that are baptized with a church, but then don't attend and don't serve and just kind of like aren't really part of...
Baptism doesn't guarantee they're going to be a faithful Christian.
Right, so...
But it's supposed to serve in this regard.
Oh, okay.
This is how we should think about baptism.
Okay.
This is what should be thought of when baptism is going on, is... hopefully when people are asking about baptism, they're like, hey, I should be baptized. This is one of the things you go over with them. By doing this, you're committing to these people, hey, I want to join with you in serving Christ.
So then hopefully if they're not going to do that, they aren't baptized?
We would probably say, if they say, hey, I want to be baptized, but I don't actually want to join with a local church, I'd say you probably don't understand what it means to be, right, baptized. Well, and you probably don't understand what it means to be a Christian if you're saying I don't want anything to do with the church.
You're commanded to be baptized,
mm-hmm,
but if being baptized also means you're saying, I'm going to serve in this church and stuff, then you should take that more seriously than just, okay, God, be baptized. Right?
Can you explain your question?
No. Can we just keep going?
Well, I don't think I understand your question, but...
Okay, I don't think I do either.
Okay. Well, if you do, write it down, or if somebody else understands, email us and we'll try to answer that. But that's okay. So, where was I? Uniting a believer to the church, like I said, I wouldn't be quite so strong on that, and marking him or her off from the world. I do agree with that, that when you are baptized, you're saying, hey, I'm joining with these people, I'm joining with Christ's people, I'm not like the world anymore. Yeah. Otherwise, I mean, especially if we think in the first century, what that was like for them, nobody, like we've mentioned, was going to be baptized and say, hey, I'm still a part of the world would say, no, you're not, you were baptized, you identified with these believers. I mean, they probably wouldn't put it in the term believers. Maybe they would. I don't know. It'd probably be in Greek anyway. So that's the rest of our walk through a definition on baptism. Again, there's more we could say on a lot of this, but it's already more in depth than I intended to go for the purposes of this show. But I thought it was fun, but also helpful, in at least provocative to thought, even if you don't agree with Jameson's definition, Jonathan Lehman's definition. He's the editor, so I'll give him a little bit of credit. It is helpful to think about what did New Testament believers think baptism was, how did they understand baptism, and how should we understand baptism? I mean, it's easy for us to think of, oh, baptism is this because I've seen it this, but we need to think a little bit more like first century, how would they have seen, pictured, done, understood baptism?
Right. And baptism isn't something that just involves the pastor and the person getting dunked.
Yep.
It involves everybody being everyday believers, everyday church members, which is kind of what our podcast is about.
So. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the most helpful aspects of his definition for me, is that he broadened my thinking to not just a pastor baptizing a believer, but a church's part and a believer's part.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a very helpful aspect of the definition. All right. Now we're over our head in baptism. We first dipped our toes in baptism, then we were up to our knees. I don't remember what I put it, and now we're over our head in baptism. Couldn't understand your question. Couldn't answer your question if I had understood it, so we're over our head. Let's move on. What are we talking about tonight?
Lord's Supper.
Yes, we're also talking about baptism, but we already finished it.
Right.
Yes, Lord's Supper, thank you. But before I jump into his definition, we'll get there at the end of the evening, I want to mention and read two passages that we're going to look at that deal with the Lord's Supper. There's one primary text that anyone that's dealt with baptism before has almost undoubtedly heard of, it, if they've dealt with it biblically. And that is 1 Corinthians 11, 23 through 34. This is a passage, or excuse me, 17 through 34. Growing up in church, we actually memorized 1 Corinthians 11, 23 through 34. And that was kind of fun. I mean, I didn't like memorizing at the time, except that I was good at it, so I liked being good at stuff.
Yeah.
But it was helpful to be able to think back through the passage, because even now I can, in King James or New King James, whatever it is, or some mix between the two, I can recite the passage and think through it in my mind, which is really nice. I appreciate that. And it's biblical. You're supposed to memorize scripture, so that was also pretty nice. But 1 Corinthians 11 is a passage that is like a primary text, or the primary text, on Lord's Supper, what it's supposed to be, what it's not supposed to be, actually. But then there's also a mention about the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 10. If you're not thinking about it, you won't really pick up on what Paul's saying. But when you stop and look at the passage and think, what does Paul mean by this bread and cup mentioned in verse 10? And why is he making a reference to a bread and cup? What would the Corinthians have thought of with Paul mentioning a bread and a cup? Well, in the very next chapter, he talks even more in depth about communion and gets to specifically Lord's Supper communion. Mm-hmm. Same thing. I'm using those interchangeably, about what was going on. But I think that's a reference in 1 Corinthians 10. If you think, what was Paul intending for them to understand when he mentions one bread and a cup, and you can't drink a cup of demons, and we'll get there. The Lord's Supper is not the cup of demons, by the way.
Right.
That's a different cup.
Yeah.
But 1 Corinthians 11, I'm going to go ahead and read 17 through 34, because it's a big chunk, and we're not going to work through all of it, but it's helpful to think through as much context as we can. I mean, I'm not going to read all of 1 Corinthians, the whole book, but
right.
As much context as we can, that's helpful for this, on what is Paul getting at when he's writing to the Corinthians. I'm not just looking at this to say, ooh, I want to learn about Lord's Supper. I do, but I want to first say, ooh, what is Paul talking about here? What is Paul trying to communicate? And then, since I already know that that's Lord's Supper, I'm going to learn about Lord's Supper. But my primary thing, my primary goal is to understand, what is Paul trying to communicate? With that being said, I'm going to read, try to read slowly, 1 Corinthians 11, 17. Do you want to read it?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think you'd read it slower than me and probably more clear than me.
17 through what?
34. 34 is on the next page. And I will sip some hot chocolate, hopefully quietly.
Okay. Now, in giving the following instruction, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For to begin with, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. There must indeed be factions among you, so that those who are approved may be recognized among you. Therefore, when you come together, it is not really to eat the Lord's Supper. For at the meal, each one eats his own supper ahead of others. So one person is hungry while another gets drunk. Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you look down on the church of God and embarrass those who have nothing? What should I say to you?
Those are harsh words. Yeah.
What should I say to you? Should I praise you? I do not praise you for this. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. On the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he also took the cup and said, "This cup is the new covenant established by my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy way will be guilty of sin against the body and blood of the Lord. So a man should examine himself in the way he should eat the bread and drink from the cup. For whoever eats and drinks without recognizing the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. This is why many are sick and ill among you, and many have fallen asleep. If we were properly evaluating ourselves, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord, so that we may not be condemned with the world. Therefore, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, he should eat at home, so that when you gather together, you will not come under judgment. And I will give instructions about the other matters whenever I come."
It's probably a good thing you read it too, because then I wouldn't interrupt myself when I was reading it as much. I tend to do that because I see something, I'm like, oh, I gotta point this out. Oh, I gotta point this out. But I don't. We'll get there. I gotta be patient.
Yeah, I feel a little intimidated by this because I know you preached on this.
I have my sermon notes up as well in case I need to reference them. But my guess is we're just gonna be able to read it. I'll make a couple of notes. I'll mention a couple things to think about. But then next week, I'll dive into the text a little bit more because, yeah, I did preach a 30-something minute message. Mm-hmm. I also talked kind of fast, so.
Yeah.
30-something minute message on 1 Corinthians 11. I guess the minutes don't matter. I preached a message on 1 Corinthians 11, but just a specific section of it. So I pulled it up, but I want to make a couple notes on this one. I don't want to caveats to scripture. I want to point out a couple things to think about. That's what I'm looking for. And then we'll read 1 Corinthians 10. So Paul, the structure of this text, Paul starts in verse 17. He's like, hey, I'm not praising you for this. I'm not going to give you any praise because you're doing it wrong. This is what you're doing. And I find that interesting because communion or Lord's Supper isn't something we really think about being a big deal. Yeah. But Paul is very strong about, I can't praise you because you're not coming together for the better, but for the worse. It's not that they're indifferent and that doing it wrong is just, oh, okay, well, it doesn't help us. But right. It actually is for the worse. It's harming them. And we see this again in the end of the chapter when he says, some of you are sick and some of you have died because you're doing this wrong. This is how much of a big deal it is. That God has chosen that some people are going to die because you're doing it wrong. You're sinning when you come together. What?
I'm sorry. As a kid, the pastor would always read that and at my growing up church, and I would be so scared that I was doing it wrong, that I confess all my sins enough because that's what they led me to believe what I needed to do.
Yeah. So that raises the next question that I was going to bring up, which is perfect.
Sorry.
No, that was really good. Is why is it that some people were being disciplined? They were being chastened by the Lord. Why is it? What does it look like to, where's the end of the chapter, properly evaluate ourselves? Well, he says in verse 31, if we were properly evaluating ourselves, we would not be judged. When we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord so that we won't be condemned with the world. But what does it mean? What does it mean to partake in a worthy manner so that we don't eat and drink judgment on ourselves? The phrase that Paul uses is, whoever eats and drinks without recognizing the body, another way to translate that would be without discerning or without understanding the body. That's what it looks like to partake in a worthy manner, is to understand the body, to discern the body, to recognize the body. If you don't do that, you eat and drink judgment on yourself. So then the question is, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. What does that mean to understand the body, to recognize the body? What's the body?
The church members.
That's good. How do you know that from the text?
Because of a verse.
Okay, so the
you have the Bible, not me.
So there's two bodies mentioned in 1 Corinthians 11, and 12 and 13 especially. Paul talks about the church as a body. Yes, mm-hmm. I think that's well within what Paul will be talking about. The only snag is he also mentions the body and blood of the Lord in verse 27 just before. But yes, I think you're on the right track. Discerning the body is talking about the church.
Because when the Lord's body is talked about, it's followed with blood or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll get there. But what does it mean to discern or understand the body? What does it mean to take communion properly? Well, Paul describes that a little bit. He in verses 23 through 26, the text we always go to, for I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. He'd already told them this. On the same night when Jesus was betrayed, he took bread, and he goes on to describe what happened. And this meal is, he says, for as often, in verse 26, for as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you remember the Lord's death until he comes. It's not what he says. You weren't looking at the text. That's okay.
You remember the Lord's death till he comes.
That's not what it says, though. What does it say?
Oh, you proclaim the Lord's death.
yeah, because what we always think is, oh, when we do this, we remember Jesus. And that's not wrong. It's incomplete. We do remember the death and resurrection of Christ. Absolutely, that's what we're doing. We're reminding ourselves of the gospel, but that's not it. It's more than that. It's not less than that, but it's more than that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we're not only just thinking to myself as I eat my cracker and juice in my apartment by myself. It's when I'm with the church body, when we all eat and drink, we proclaim to one another the Lord's death until he comes. But I think I've gone into answering questions rather than just posing them. But what does it mean? Why does Paul say you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes in verse 26? That's the question I want you to think about. All right, 1 Corinthians 10. I'm not going to read lots of the context right here, right now, because we're running a little short on time. We'll be okay. But I'll go ahead and read verses 14 through 22. That's the chunk, I think, that we'll be primarily looking at. I'll go outside of that if there's something that I don't know the answer to from that context. I'll broaden the context to answer what's this thing talking about. But 1 Corinthians 10, 14 through 22, and I won't interrupt myself. I'll just keep reading the whole way through. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. I am speaking as to wise people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we give thanks for, is it not a sharing in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a sharing in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for all of us share that one bread. Look at the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in what is offered on the altar? What am I saying then? That food is offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. But I do say that what they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to participate with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot share in the Lord's table and the table of demons. Or are we provoking the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? And he ends with a question. But there's references to one bread, and that's what makes us one body, because there's one bread. And there's references to cups, the cup of demons and the cup of the Lord's table and the table of demons. I think that's a pretty clear reference to, well, Lord's table. It's where we get the name Lord's table, communion, Lord's supper. But what are the implications of that text for how we think about communion? I think I'll leave it with just that question. To end, I'll go ahead and read Bobby Jameson's definition of the Lord's Supper, unless you would like to read it. You're very good at reading things with good pronunciation and not rushing, unlike me. And also, I can drink some hot chocolate, but mostly you're better at it.
Okay. Definition of the Lord's Supper. A church's act of communing with Christ and each other and of commemorating Christ's death by partaking of bread and wine, and a believer's act of receiving Christ's benefits and renewing his or her commitment to Christ and his people, thereby making the church one body and marking it off from the world.
Thank you. Yeah, see, much better than if I had tried to read it.
I'm sure you do fine.
It's pretty quick. Plus, I like hearing your voice. So oh, that's that's Jameson's definition. And we'll dive into a little bit more. I think that'll be 2 weeks from now, because my guess is next week, it'll depend on how fast and how much I dive into in 1 Corinthians 11 and how much I touch on from 1 Corinthians 10. But we might get to the definition next week, but I want to try to knock the whole definition out in 1 week when we do.
Yeah.
Even if it's part of something else, I want to try to knock it all out. I think that'll be pretty fun. All right, we're going to leave it off there.
Okay.
We're not concluding, because we're reading. Kind of.
Yeah, we have what we're reading.
Yeah. So, I like the segment breakdown. What we're doing, what we're learning, and what we're reading.
Yeah.
All right, what are we reading?
We're reading Prince Caspian.
Yes, we're still making our way through it. And I hate that the chapters are so short, even though the one last night seemed really long.
Yeah, it did.
It seemed really long, but that was probably because I'm reading, and I'm not very used to Lewis's style of writing yet. And it takes me by surprise when he ends sentences and when he doesn't, and also the slightly, is it British?
Maybe.
Oh, now I feel like an idiot.
Why?
I don't know where he's from or how he, the style of language. That's a slightly different style of language. Well, for one, it's from a slightly different period in time.
Yeah.
But it just, it's a different style and a different flow of words and sentences and things. And he reminds me of Paul sometimes. Not because of his theological accuracy, but because, I mean, it's not bad, but hit run-ons. just lists. Lists this and 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 this alongside this and this and this, not to mention this and this and this and this and this. The list of, the thing that comes to mind is the list of subjects that Prince Caspian was studying.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all of these things, and he just lists forever. It'd be like if I tried to list all of my discs in disc golf, and I have this and this and this and this and this, not to mention these five putters and this and this. Yeah, that's what it reminds me of. But sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he has just a quick, like, short chop.
Yeah, he's into that variety.
Yeah.
We learned about in 10th grade or whatever it was.
He is good. I do appreciate his writing. I think it is helpful, and it is age appropriate. And if I was reading in my head, it'd probably be easier. But when I'm reading out loud, it catches me off guard because I'm trying to add inflection out loud versus it just in my mind.
Oh, it's probably good growth for your brain.
It is, probably.
Yeah.
Especially because it's late at night. Well, not late. Like 8:45. Which is pretty late. All right, and what else?
We're thinking about leaving church.
No. I even put that in the note. Oh, my goodness. No. So we're doing some research on when people should leave a church. Not because we're thinking about leaving. Not at all. We're not thinking about leaving Anchor. If you go to our church, don't spread rumors that we're trying to leave Anchor. I know one person that wants to listen to this podcast. The next Sunday, they're going to come up to me and be like, so, you're thinking about leaving Anchor? I think you know who I'm thinking about. But they're jokester. They're funny. So I would laugh. And I'd know that they're talking about the podcast and that they listened, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. But we're doing research on that because it's a question I've brought up and I don't know how to answer.
Yeah.
And it's come up more and more. Not because we know lots of people trying to leave churches, but it does come up every once in a while, and I don't know of many good resources on it. So where I'm starting is Nine Marks has some resources on how to find a good church.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with that and then probably work my way backwards, see if they say anything about how many of those criteria it needs to meet. Maybe it needs to meet all of them. Maybe they have to meet all nine marks of a good church. Maybe there's one that, well, this one's kind of iffy, so then it's okay. Or maybe, oh, as long as it meets these are like the key things. I'm going to see what they say. And also, I want to keep in mind that, well, one of the marks is like biblical preaching. Mm-hmm. So let's say one Sunday we go to church and there's a guest preacher and he doesn't preach something that's very theologically sound. We've had some of these in chapel before. They come in and usually there's a caveat afterwards by somebody like, hey, maybe just don't go down this rabbit hole theologically. But if we have one day where the preaching isn't theologically sound, does that mean, nope, we're leaving the church? Well, probably not. I want to think big picture of the trajectory as a whole of the church and not just how the pastor preaches, which is important, but not everything, because there's more to a church than the pastor preaching.
You know what I just thought of?
What?
While we were talking about picking churches?
What?
You know what I'm glad we don't have to pick?
Pastor's wives?
No, children. Our own children.
Yeah. I wouldn't want any of them.
You wouldn't want any children?
No. I want children now. And I'm like, yeah, bring on the kids. I can take all the kids. That'll be fun. But if I had to go into like an orphanage or something and be like, here, pick out a kid, I'd be like, oh, I don't want any of these. But then if one's born to me, I'm like, oh, they're the best.
But like if they, like, if kids came with a list of all their pros and cons, I'm glad we don't have to pick our kids. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sidetrack.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm reading. That's the angle I'm coming at it from so far to start with, and we'll see where it goes. Maybe there is something written on that. If not, maybe I won't write it, but maybe I can talk someone into writing it. It'd be fun. Maybe I'll compile a list of things I found helpful, and we'll see what happens from there. But
yeah,
there's got to be something somewhere, but maybe not by somebody that's biblically sound.
Yeah.
I don't know. But that's what I'm reading. That's what I'm researching. It's not like a book that I'm reading for certain. There are a couple of reference books that I've checked out that I have in mind that I want to look at as well, but not like a book that I'm reading through on that. But that's what we're reading. We made it all the way through. We're not reading much else.
Nope. It's been really busy around the holidays.
Yeah. It's good though.
I
enjoy it. Well, yeah. All right. I think that's going to be where we wrap it up for now. Hopefully that gave you something to think about on 1 Corinthians 11. Maybe it whet your appetite to to get in there and read a little bit of the context of 1 Corinthians 11 and pick apart what Paul was trying to communicate, what Paul was trying to tell to them. And we do know that Paul was sometimes hard to understand. Even Peter mentioned that. So it is worth the research. But for now, hope you keep thinking about that. And I hope you keep serving or start serving in your local church. Bye.
Bye.